Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for December 2014. This is issue number 359. I'm your host, Fred Bobe. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. My email for general inquiries is fvobe, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio.com. That's R-E-A-L, oldiesradio.com. My home telephone number for short calls is 419-228-6223. That number is not to be used for musings. The musings number is 419-741-0205. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is $30. The magazine is published on CDs, and to subscribe or renew, make a check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. And if you're on the Internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. But subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone else's assistance. We have some sad news to report. Graham Maynard, a noted British medium-wave DXer, passed away on October the 6th. Many will know his receiver modifications and antenna designs, including the ferrite sleeve loop antenna that had become popular with the ultralight DXers. An archive of his technical articles is being maintained at a website. The short URL to that is dxas.org/1412GM, and GM is small letters. The 35th edition of the National Radio Club's AM Radio Log is available and shipping. The National Radio Club's AM Radio Log is the leading source of information on AM radio stations in the United States and Canada. As always, this edition is a 8.5x11, three-hole punched, U.S. loose-leaf format. This publication fits nicely into a 1-inch, three-ring binder. Additional references include call letters of FM simulcasts with the AM stations listing of regional groups of stations in the group section, a separate section, by the way, of all the log, a cross-reference of those stations that are licensed to use IBOC, that's in-band on-channel digital audio, and a comprehensive list of FM translators that are now simulcasting with AM broadcasters. You can order by USPS, by check or money order, in U.S. funds to the National Radio Club, Post Office Box 473-251, Aurora, Colorado, 80047-3251, or order using your PayPal account at www.nrcdxas.org. If you have any inquiries, email sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. I'd like to remind members to please be patient when inquiring about your DX audio service. The best way to contact me is by email or letter. Because I'm on the road and away a lot, a telephone call might not be the quickest method. Keep in mind that the DX audio service is mailed at the end of the month for the preceding month. This means your January DX Audio Service is mailed on or about December the 30th. You should always allow your post office ample time to deliver to you, and we would prefer that you wait until the 20th or 30th of the month before you ask for replacements. Speaking of replacements, if you have a damaged disc, you don't need to contact anyone to ask what to do. Simply place the damaged disc in the mailer and send it right back to us. Damaged discs are replaced at no charge if you return them. Or you can just buy a replacement from the Publication Center for $3. A quick mention about subscriptions. I'd prefer that you renew before your subscription runs out. This keeps your subscription from missing a month or two. If your subscription runs out with the January issue, mail in your renewal by December. Also, if you're short on cash, you can get half years at $15, but you have to pay by check. We can't do half years by PayPal. And on the other side, if you have a good night at playing bingo, you can always pay two or more years ahead just to keep from getting snagged with dues increases up the road. Renewals can be made at any time, and your last issue is always printed on your mailing label. Time now on the DX Audio Service for Dave Alpert with the AM Switch. If you happen to hear something that you feel is important, please give us a call at area code 419-741-0205 and let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Now here's Dave.
Hi, it's Dave Alpert with a cold December AM Switch. This issue, we have two editions, AM Switch Volume 82, Issues 3 and 4. We begin, as usual, with the changes to call letters announced by the FCC. 690 KBLI Blackfoot, Idaho, changed to KEII. 740 KBOE Oskaloosa, Iowa, changes to KMZN. That took place October 15th. 950 KMTX Helena, Montana, changed to KCAP on November 6th. But what's that you say? There's a KCAP already on 1340? We'll get to that later. Another three-letter call bites the dust as 1240 KGY Olympia, Washington, changes to KBUP on November 6th. 1260 KBLY Idaho Falls, Idaho, becomes KEIR. 1280 WFAU Gardner, Maine, is now WJYE. 1380 WTJK South Beloit returns to their old call letters WBEL October 13th. They had WBEL until 1998. Another returnee is 1440 WDRJ Inkster, Michigan, suburban Detroit, changed back to WMKM on October 6th. They had the WMKM calls most of 1990 to 2006. 1500 WTNE, Trentum, Tennessee, becomes WPOT. And a similar situation to KMTX. 1560 WLYG, Center, Alabama, changes to WZTQ on October 13th, as the WZTQ call is now silent. In addition, the new owners of 810 WTHV Hahira, Georgia, has reserved WZYN for when the sale of the station is complete, and the new owners of WJAX 1220 Jacksonville, Florida, have reserved WKTZ. The latter sale has now closed, so the call change may be imminent. If you're near Jacksonville, let us know. Under New Station Watch, we have some drama. 540 KJJL Pine Bluffs, Wyoming. The FCC rejected an appeal of the 2009 denial of license to cover this new station CP. The FCC found that the applicant had falsely certified the station, including five 344-foot towers, was built when it applied for the license to cover at the end of the three-year construction window, when it had only completed 225 feet of one tower and 125 feet of the others. The 1550 CP in Midland, Texas, for a new station has expired. It has now been deleted. In addition to the two additional outstanding CPs that technically expired in October, Paradise, Nevada on 1590 and Fritch, Texas on 1570, four more CPs are set to expire in November. They are KCKQ 1180 Sparks, Nevada, KMCA 1450 Hilo, Hawaii, the CP for 1400 and Pauka, Hawaii, and WIVS 1560 Village of Superior, Wisconsin. Under FCC rules, the permittee must substantially complete the building of the station and file for a license within the three-year deadline, otherwise the license automatically expires. Stations going dark. 620 WJHX, Lexington, Alabama. The FCC sent a letter to the licensee of this station along with 1450 WZGX stating that both licenses were being canceled for being silent for more than a year. They've been off since July 15, 2013. The letter came back, return to sender, no such number, unable to forward. So the licenses have been canceled and the call signs deleted. 950 WGTA Somerville, Georgia, license canceled on November 3rd, no reason given on the FCC site. 1010 WCOC Dora, Alabama, is calling it quits. License voluntarily surrendered on November 3rd. 1300 WKXM Winfield, Alabama. License canceled at licensee's request in an October 17th letter to the FCC. Here is why KMTX now has the KCAP call sign. 1340 KCAP Helena, Montana, voluntarily surrendered their license and went off the air on October 30th. As we said before, 1450 KZGX Bessemer, Alabama, is now silent as they didn't answer a letter to them, and WJHX 620. 1470 WJPI Plymouth, North Carolina, has been silent since April 1st, 2011. And that's no joke. WJPI has been listed as deleted since 2012, but now finally removed from FCC database. In addition, these long-deleted stations have finally been removed from the FCC AM query database. They include WBBA 1580 Pittsfield, Illinois, WRDD 1580 Ebensburg, Pennsylvania, WZRK 1590 Jackson, Mississippi, and WQLO 1590 Sun Valley, Nevada. Construction permits for existing stations. ECPs are built and nearing final licensing. 1010 KCEO Vista, California applies for license to cover their CP for U4 10,000 watts day, 900 watts night. 1170 WDEK Lexington, South Carolina applies for license to cover their CP for D1 10,000 watts day and critical hours power of 3,000 watts from a new site. 1230 KSGG Reno, Nevada's CP for U1, 1,000 watts day and night is on from a new site. 1320 KXYZ Houston, Texas applies for license to cover their CP for U4, 10 kilowatts day, 5 kilowatts night. 1360 WMOB Mobile, Alabama has their CP for U4, 9,000 watts day, 200 watts night from a new site on the air. 1320 KXYZ Houston, Texas applies for license to cover their CP for U4, 10 kilowatts day, 5 kilowatts night. 1340 KIKO Apache Junction, Arizona. According to John Johnson, who lives in Mesa, this CP was heard testing on October 28th. However, nothing on the FCC site yet. CPs on the air. 660 WORL Altamont Springs, Florida has their CP for U4 3500 watts day and 1000 watts night on the air. The CP for 1370 KRAC Red Bluff, California for U4 4000 watts day, 200 watts night, moving from Quincy, California, is on. 1460 KHOJ St. Charles, Missouri's CP for U4 12000 watts day and 210 watts night is on the air. And finally, 1460 WRAD Radford, Virginia applies for license to cover their CP for U1 5000 watts day and 37 watts night. These applications for construction permits filed. 1110 KRPA Oak Harbor, Washington applies for U4, 9,000 watts day, 2,500 watts night from a new site located southeast of the old site and directional to the northwest. 1200 WXIT Blowing Rock, North Carolina granted a CP with D1, 4,200 watts, moving to the WATA 1450 tower. 1500 KCLF New Roads, Louisiana applies for U1 850 watts day and 18 watts night from a new site, which is a couple miles west of their present location. 1560 WPAD Paducah, Kentucky granted a CP with U1 1000 watts day and 35 watts night using one of the existing four towers of their 10,000 watt array. 1580 WLPK Connersville, Indiana applies for U1 245 watts day and 4.6 watts night and corrects the coordinates. The site is at the intersection of State Route 44 and 121. Construction permit for auxiliary transmitter 1260 WWRC Washington, D.C. is granted a CP for an auxiliary transmitter D1 2900 watts from the WAVA 780 tower located northwest of the district. And we have one CP expired, 1520 WXYB, Indian Rocks Beach, Florida. WXYB's CP was for U1, 640 watts day and 17 watts night. The FCC deleted that one, but the application for U1, 1,000 watts day and 13 watts night is still pending. Now let's look at special temporary authority. 630 WMFD, Wilmington, North Carolina, granted an STA with U1, 200 watts day and night due to a copper theft. Someone stole their grounding system. 630 KPLY, Reno, Nevada, granted an STA with U1, 5,000 watts day, 250 watts night, while new station CP KCKQ 1180 is diplexed to one of KPLY's towers. 750 KOAL, Price, Utah, is granted an STA with U1, 4,000 watts day, 1,700 watts night, as they lost a day tower in a storm on September 27th. 910 WSRP, Jacksonville, North Carolina, granted an STA with U1, 1 kilowatt day and night, due to technical problems with their pattern and transmitter, and they state they have no money to fix them. 1050 WMSG, Oakland, Maryland, applies for an STA with U1, 400 watts day and 75 watts night to replace their transmitter. 1060 WRHL, Rochelle, Illinois, applies for an STA with minor adjustment to towers. 1060 WGSB, Mebane, North Carolina, is granted an STA with D1, 250 watts day, critical hours, 125 watts, as they say they can only use one tower. 1310 KKNS, Corrales, New Mexico, applies for an STA with U1, 500 watts day and night from a temporary site at 1583 Sunset Garden Southwest in Albuquerque. They say in their filing they lost their main site. 1370 WLLN, Lillington, North Carolina, granted an STA with U1, 1,000 watts day, 49 watts night, due to a damaged transmitter. 1390 WCAT, Burlington, Vermont, granted an STA with reduced night power, the power level unspecified. Apparently, they're having problems with their pattern after diplexing an FM translator. 1410 WIZM, La Crosse, Wisconsin, is granted an STA with U1, 5,000 watts day and 1,250 watts at night as needed during phaser replacement. 1470 WNYY, Ithaca, New York, granted an STA with U1, 5,000 watts day, 250 watts night, while 8 FM translators are diplexed to the towers. 1480 KTHS, Green Forest, Arkansas, is granted an STA with U1, 30 watts day and night with a rented transmitter. KTHS's main transmitter was ruined by a lightning strike. 1520 KOKC, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, applies for an STA with parameters at variance for U1, 50,000 watts day, 12,500 watts night during pattern work. 1530 KZNX, Creedmoor, Texas, granted an STA with U3, 220 watts day and night, night pattern and site only, because they're having problems at the day site, which is currently inoperable. Okay, time to venture into the morgue with silent stations, but first, let's take a look at resurrected AM stations. These are formerly silent stations informing the FCC they are back on the air. They include 910 WSRP, Jacksonville, North Carolina, silent since October 17, 2013, back on with an STA on October 1st. 1060 WGSB, Mebane, North Carolina, was silent since October 17, 2013, and is back on with an STA October 14th. 1170 WDEK, Lexington, South Carolina, went silent October 16, 2013. They're on with a CP October 15th this year. 1220 WREV, Reidsville, North Carolina, was silent since October 17, 2013, and is back on as of September 30th. 1250 WYKM, Rupert, West Virginia, fell silent on July 12th due to lightning, but is back on as of August 4th. 1250 KDEI, Port Arthur, Texas, silent on September 19th, back on October 23rd. 1370 WLLN, Lillington, North Carolina, was silent since October 17, 2013, but they've returned on an STA on September 25th. And according to National Radio Club member Dave Schmidt, WHYL 960 is still silent, but WPDC 1600 is back on the air. No word yet on either of these from the FCC. And finally, the deceased. These are stations now off the air. A quick reminder, if you hear them back on, let us know by calling the Musing Line. We'll just give you only the frequency and call sign for the sake of brevity here. It's a pretty long list. 580 KZMX, 590 WARM, 610 KVLE, 700 WCNF, 780 WIIN, 840 WHGH, 850 WKGE, 860 WAMI, 930 WEZZ, 930 WTOU, 950 KSEW, 1000 WRAR, 1060 KRUZ, 1060 WLNO, 1090 KQNM, 1120 KLIM, 1130 WALQ, 1170 WDIS, 1180 KORL, 1190 KNEK, 1210 WDGR, 1220 KQMG, 1240 WNRA, 1240 KBLL, 1260 KIMB, 1270 WHGS, 1270 WHEO, 1280 WOWZ, 1300 WSSG, 1300 KSET, 1310 WDTW, 1310 KKNS, 1330 WJSS, 1330 KUKU, 1340 KIKO, 1340 WCMI, 1340 KTSN, 1340 WKSN, 1340 KJMU, 1340 KOLE, 1340 KCRN, 1340 WXKX, 1350 WCBA, 1350 WNVA, 1360 KBYO, 1360 WGBN, 1360 WHJC, 1390 WAJD, 1390 KZQQ, 1400 WJWF, 1400 WSPG, 1430 KCRX, 1440 WDXQ, 1440 WSEL, 1440 KETX, 1450 WBVA, 1450 WHNK, 1460 WPON, 1460 KARR, 1480 WQTM, 1490 WSYL, 1490 WOLF, 1490 KFCR, 1490 KWUD, 1490 KJNT, 1500 WQMS, 1500 KDFN, 1520 WTRI, 1530 WLWB, 1540 WJZI, 1540 WYCL, 1550 WKTF, 1550 WVAB, 1550 WZRK, 1560 WZTQ, 1560 KIQS, 1560 WLZR, 1560 WQXY, 1570 KBRI, 1580 WNTF, 1580 WTCL, 1590 WPUL, 1590 WIJK, 1600 WRJE, 1600 WPDC, and 1660 KXOL. I said it was a long list. Again, if you hear any of these stations back on the air, please call the Musings line at 419-741-0205, 24 hours a day, and let us know. FCC fines, yep, we have a few. KLRG 880 in Sheridan, Arkansas. The former licensee was fined for tower fencing violation. The fine was reduced from $7,000 to $5,600. KOAN 1080 in Anchorage, Alaska was fined $5,600 for violations of the antenna structure fencing rules. That fine reduced also from $7,000. It was originally assessed in 2012. An AM tower is electrically hot with the transmitting signal. As little as 5 watts can burn your fingers if you touch the tower. Powers of 1,000 watts or above can cause significant third-degree burns. The FCC does not take this offense lightly, and neither should the licensee. Finally, let's take a look at some news from Canada. 980 CHRF Montreal, Quebec. The CP for this new station was heard testing on October 12th and was scheduled to formally launch in mid-November. It'll be broadcasting in French for Montreal's LGBT community. 980 CKNW New Westminster, British Columbia applies for an FM repeater on 99.7, but said in their filing they are not moving to FM. 1140 CBI Sydney, Nova Scotia applies for an FM repeater on 92.1, but is also not moving to FM. 1150 CKOC Hamilton, Ontario granted a CP for U3 50,000 watts day, 20 kilowatts at night, and will move from their 5 towers day and 10 tower night site to a single 6 tower pattern day and night. According to our resident directional antenna engineer Fred Vobey, the day pattern is about the same, but the lobe has been shifted more east from 340 degrees to about 7 degrees. The night pattern goes in the same direction, but is a narrower lobe. 1320 CJMR Oakville, Ontario. Dan Siss says the Industry Canada database has quietly changed the city of license here to Oakville from Mississauga, Ontario. And to wrap it up, 1340 CBEU Temagami, Ontario. This low-power relay transmitter was granted a CP to move to 106.1 FM. As soon as it's on, the AM will turn in its license. We'd like to thank Sean Axelrod, Bill Hale, Glenn Hauser, Mark DiLorenzo, Susan Earns, who is GM of KSID, Pete Taylor, Steve Kennedy, Troy Dreyfus, co-owner of Pirate Radio, WDLX, WGHB, Bill Dvorak, Fred Vobey, Bob Hill, Neil Griffin, Craig Christ, Scott Feibusch, and DX Mid-America for reports and corrections on this issue. Without you, this column would not be the most accurate listing on broadcast AM stations. I'm Dave Alpert from sunny and warm Los Angeles, turning the microphone over to Mark Durenberger, who's experienced a change in the weather. Mark?
Thanks, Dave, and happy holidays, everyone. Hope you can wait a few more weeks for Santa, and that the old man is good to you this year. You deserve it. For our part, our December 2014 offering is a bit of time travel. We're going to visit the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting and walk through some of the hundreds of exhibits with curator Steve Raymer. A number of you were part of the Pavick experience during our 2013 DX convention, but if you're like me, you can always use and hear another look. We are in a very special place. We're standing next to Steve Raymer, who is the director of the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting.
Thank you, Mark, and it's an honor to be here today, and hopefully we can give you something that is worthwhile. We've got a variety of collections here at the Pavick. We've got Joe Pavick's original collection of old radios from the 20s, and we've got another collection that was put together of radios built in the Twin Cities. But one of our most significant collections was put together by Bing Crosby's audio engineer. His name was Jack Mullen, and it documents the history of recorded sound. It starts with an Edison tinfoil machine. And by the way, if you come here to visit, you can put your hands on this machine and touch it and feel it, really get a sense of how it works. This is the first device capable of recording and playing back the human voice. And it was done on a sheet of tinfoil that was wrapped around a drum in the middle of the device.
This drum looks like it's about, 4 inches in diameter, made out of brass?
Mm-hmm. No. There's two diaphragms, one on either side of it with needles attached. You shout into one side, and the diaphragm causes the needle to vibrate. It leaves the footprint of the sound in the tinfoil so that it can be played back.
And then you turn a crank.
Yeah, there's no electric motor on this one. This is 1877. So the playback speed was determined by how fast or how slow you cranked it and what sounded right to you.
And what kind of quality would you expect from this?
Terrible. Yeah. It was terrible. And we actually found some of this old tinfoil and tried to get the thing to work, and the tinfoil would rip and tear, and it's a miracle that he got anything out of this at all. In order to solve those problems, he went to a more permanent media, wax cylinders. Now he could record on one machine and play it back on another.
It's a wooden box, about 14 by 12 by maybe 10. And at the top, there's a disc that presumably goes around.
A cylinder.
Okay. And underneath, there's a cone. It looks like it. Is that the loudspeaker?
Mm-hmm.
Not where the sound comes out?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a big funnel.
And it's you can see how it's based on the original tinfoil machine. There's a cylinder of wax that spins at 160 RPM.
Oh, well, that's what, five times as fast as the LP record?
Yes, yes. You can get 4 minutes out of one of these cylinders. The earlier ones were 2 minutes. This one's four.
So this is what, spring-powered?
Yeah.
There's a crank on here. That's just for winding up the spring.
Correct.
Okay.
And then it has a flyball governor, so it's like a clockwork motor.
So what are we going to hear here?
I'm going to drop the stylus and diaphragm down on the record, on the cylinder. And, well, let's see if we recognize this tune. The important thing is, though, that Edison initially had to make these one at a time. If you wanted 50 copies of a song, he had to sing it 50 times. By the time he had a system figured out to cast the records, where the record would actually shrink inside the mold, Berliner and Johnson had come up with the flat disc. And they took over the industry because they could just stamp them out.
And so the flat discs were not individually cut.
They were
mass produced.
And that was the key to their success. And Edison was out of the phonograph business by 1929. Here's a Victor machine. And this is going to be quite a bit louder.
Now we're looking at a 78 RPM?
Yes.
Did 78 become the speed at the very beginning of all of this?
There were a variety of speeds, but this is the one that gave him a nice amount of time, about 3.5 minutes on a disc, and that sounded good.
10-inch disc. So 78 RPM became the so-called calculated speed to give you 3 to 3.5 minutes on a 10-inch disc.
Correct.
I see. Okay.
Right. And Edison, he actually ran at 80 RPM.
Why?
Victor patented virtually every step of every process that they did. They had some early legal battles with some of their former employees, and they learned their lesson, and including the materials that they were made of and the speed that they operated at. So when Edison finally succumbed and went over to the flat disc, he couldn't use their speed, he couldn't use their materials.
So he recorded at 80 RPM, and if you had a standard phonograph in your home and played his back, they would have sounded a little slower.
Well, and then the problem was you couldn't play his back on a standard phonograph because his records were vertical cut, deeper and shallower cut, whereas the Victor's were lateral cut, side to side. So here's a Victor machine, and again, this is a... The reproducer bounces back and forth, or the needle bounces back and forth.
Well, now this time I'm looking into a horn that's about 2 feet in diameter, 3 feet deep, and it's coupled. What's that material? Sintered bronze or something, do you think? But it's all acoustically coupled down to a diaphragm that's going to be tickled by the stylus. Am I right?
Yeah, and how big is that diaphragm?
Oh, 2 inches.
2 inches?
Yeah.
So this 2-inch diaphragm moves, what, a 16th of an inch, a 32nd of an inch back and forth?
Depending on the sound that's vibrating the needle.
And it's amazing how much audio you get from that little diaphragm.
Oh, it's getting up to speed. I would note that you had no way of adjusting the volume. This was a direct acoustical thing. I know you're going to show me one in a minute where they were able to do that, but...
And that's where the old term, put a sock in it, comes from. Because you could ball up a pair of socks and throw it inside the horn, and that would quiet it down.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
The recording process at the time was a mirror image of what we just heard. There was, you talked and sang into a horn.
If you had a soft disc on here, a soft plastic disc, Mark and I could shout into this horn, and that diaphragm on the reproducer would vibrate enough to etch the footprint of our sound, of our voices, into that disc.
It had a real inherent drawback in that the low frequencies didn't get through that
system, correct? And it really wasn't until 1925 that they figured this out.
Now Steve is opening a huge piece of furniture.
And once again, this is something that when you come here, you can put your hands on it, you can feel this thing work, you can envision how this record changer operates. This is the first record changer for the home market. This is a playback system that Victor and Bell Labs co-designed. They spent many years working on it, lots of money, and by the time they brought it out to market, it was completely obsolete.
So what we're looking at is a 78 RPM turntable with the acoustical pickup on it, just like the one we just heard. And this one, I'm assuming, gets coupled into a horn somewhere.
It's a much larger horn, and the diaphragm on the acoustical pickup is no longer a flat sheet of mica. It's a dome of aluminum, and aluminum at the time was a precious metal. And there's ball bearings in the mechanism. And again, it was completely obsolete by the time it was introduced, because by 1927, we had vacuum tube amplifiers.
So we were into electrical recording by that time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the proper records for this, the orthophonic records, were recorded electrically using a microphone, and then they were equalized to be played back acoustically.
There's a record on the turntable. Remember, folks, we're talking about 78 RPM discs, which are extremely fragile. What are they made out of?
They're made out of slate dust and shellac.
So if I drop one on a hard floor, it would shatter?
They would break,
yeah. So you wonder what the machine is going to do with it. It's got one disc up in the air.
On a hook, and actually we could have put a dozen discs up there.
All right, see what it does.
Okay.
Now, this one you said has a huge horn on it. May I open this?
Yes. Unfortunately, all you can see is grill cloth.
Okay, but it's big.
Yeah, and we're not able to really... It's somewhere between 8 and 12 feet total length. And, of course, the horn begins at the reproducer, and that acoustic tube counts as the length of the...
So the sound travels through the tube that's holding the needle on the record, and then down through some kind of a chamber somewhere that gets bigger and bigger.
And a big chunk of that chamber is cast iron.
Mercy.
They determined that cast iron would not diminish the sound. And then the final opening is a spruce horn. So they have a very, scientifically...
It's quite well-crafted, isn't it? So now, back to your comment about put a sock in it. And that's essentially what we're going to demonstrate here, correct?
Well, first of all, we're going to drop the tone arm on the record. We have an electric motor now. And that's full volume right there.
Now, the doors are open.
Should I turn it down?
It's pretty loud. Yeah, Steve, turn it down. It's got quieter. And now the doors are closed. So if I wanted it a little bit louder, just partially open one of the doors. That's such happy music, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit too happy. I'm going to hear a little bit more.
Mechanically, it took the record off the turntable, these delicate records off the turntable, and shoved it down a slot. Took the one that was hanging in the air, and now it's on the machine. My goodness.
So if you recognize this voice.
I don't recognize the voice yet.
You will. Maybe.
I'm coming, Virginia.
That's Bing Crosby.
Very good. Now, your listeners didn't have a chance to hear that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know who that is. Again, this is all acoustic. We haven't even begun to get to the electric recordings.
And again, this was completely obsolete by the time it was introduced because we had amplifiers and we had microphones by 1927.
And that led us to the following demonstration.
We do have a demo here that shows the difference between an acoustic recording and an electrical recording. Mullen was able to find both these versions of a recording. He found the electrical recording and the acoustic recording of the same tune. That's the source, sound source that you're going to hear.
What are we going to hear first?
I bet you you'll be able to figure it out. This is the acoustic version. And it's better than it should be.
Now we've switched.
This
All right, that was amazing.
This is the lathe that cut the discs for the first talkies.
What's a lathe?
Well, a lathe is a device that turns at a precise speed, and there's a cutting head that moves across the record at a predetermined rate.
So that threaded screw goes around at X RPM. And that drives a mechanism that slowly moves the cutting needle from the outside to the inside or from the inside to the outside. But it's done very exactingly.
Very precise, and this thing weighs a ton. And we have a wooden base holding it up now, but the original base would have been concrete. So there was no vibration at all. This is a lathe originally designed to cut the discs for the first talkies. You know, originally movies were silent, and eventually they put the sound on the film. But for a couple of years, they tried synchronizing a record to the film. At that time, a reel of film was 11 minutes long, and it was 16 inches in diameter.
The film was?
Yeah, the reel of film was 16 inches in diameter. So they made this record the same size as the film can, 16 inches, and then they slowed it down from 78 RPM till they got 11 minutes, and the new speed was?
33 and a third RPM.
33 and a third. And that's how that standard was established.
And that disc became known as the ET, or electrical transcription, and was heavily used in broadcast operations.
Well, the movie industry figured out within a year or two how to put sound on film. So they gave up on it. But the broadcasters realized that they could get 15 minutes per side, and you've now got, between the two sides, a half-hour radio show. And I know a few stations in this town continued to use this system up into the 1960s. Even though we had tape, the engineers could see or feel where the cut began on this record and where it ended, and were happy to use them. Whereas with the tape, they had to rely on a tape counter, which may or may not have been accurate.
Right. And it, you have to spin it back and forth. You can break the tape. So you've taken us through the electrical transcription, which really formed the basis of all future development of phonograph recording.
The real foundation of our programming is the Joe Pavitt Collection, which starts with our first exposure to electricity. We've got some early generators and batteries and Leyden jars.
What is this device?
This is an early generator. It's from about 1850.
Generator meaning it creates electricity?
Yeah, static electricity. You can't really draw any current. You can't run a motor with this, but you can get a shock from it.
And it's because you are...
There's two pads that they actually rubbed a little bit of gold dust on, and there's a glass disc, and as you turn the handle, the glass disc rotates, rubs against these two pads, which they actually called rubbers at the time, and the static electricity collects along this large brass rail that kind of runs in a big rectangle around the device, and there's just enough room in the middle of that rail to put a Leyden jar. A Leyden jar is a capacitor. It only stores a temporary charge, but you can get a big charge in there, you can get a big shock, but it will not produce a continuous flow of electricity like a battery does.
It'll get your attention, but it won't kill you.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, experiments with this sort of thing eventually led to some practical applications. The one that the Pavitt Collection is interested in is electronic communication, which... we've gotten some dispute about this. I always say it begins with the telegraph. But one time I was giving the presentation and a kid said, "What about the doorbell?" And he was right.
Yeah. Yeah.
The doorbell was electronic communication, but the telegraph was two-way. You could send and receive messages with the telegraph. And, of course, the telephone... And then finally, the wireless telegraph, which we call radio today. And this is really developed for ships at sea. Ships at sea could not run wires from ship to ship or ship to shore. They needed to figure out some way to send messages out over the air. And right around 1900, they came up with this device that's once again sitting all in the open. And it's not plugged in. It's turned off. Very dangerous. There's going to be 13,000 volts jumping across the spark gap when we fire it up.
Oh, we are going to fire it up?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
This is a small version of the transmitter that was on the Titanic. Matter of fact, it's just as old. These components are all from around 1912. And I'm going to send out an SOS and hope somebody hears it.
I detected SOS in the keying that you just did. And you said, what, 13,000 volts?
There's 13,000 volts across the...
So how far would this reach?
The Titanic was out 1,000 miles.
And was heard on shore?
Yes, was heard along the East Coast by David Sarnoff.
We're only partway through the Pavic experience, but we need to make room for the rest of this month's information. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service will complete our tour of the Pavic in 30 days. Until then, an early wish for Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and good listening, DXers.
I'm Charlie Van Dyke, and you're listening to the DX Audio Service from the National Radio Club.
Chicago. Let's recap the 1390 WSPO Charleston, South Carolina DX test. This test apparently was very well heard throughout the nation and in other countries. Noting reports in the various forums and DX columns, the DX test was heard in Clarendon, New York, Joliet, Illinois, Alcoa, Tennessee, Rossville, Tennessee, Palm Coast, Florida, Clifton, New Jersey, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Northeast Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, Seaside, Oregon, Malin, Alabama, Akron, Ohio, Macomb, Illinois, Ridgeville, South Carolina, Woodbury, Minnesota, Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, Omaha, Nebraska, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Springfield, Massachusetts, Austin, Texas, Blairstown, New Jersey, State College, Pennsylvania, Fairhope, Alabama, Foley, Alabama, Lynn, Massachusetts, Holly, New York, Memphis, Tennessee, Lexington, Kentucky, and the test was also heard in Norway and Sweden. Here's an example of how the test was heard in Lexington, Kentucky, as recorded by DX Audio Service editor Chris Gay. Chris was using a Kenwood TS-2000 receiver and a Gap Eagle vertical antenna. By equalizing and enhancing the audio, we could hear the CW a little bit better in this recording. In broadcast engineering, we use what is known as a sweep tone to be able to check the linearity of an AM transmitter to make sure that all frequencies will pass both through the transmitter and the antenna system. A sweep tone sounds something like this. Now, listen carefully, and you can hear the sweep tone from WSPO in this recording. Torloff Johansson of Uppsala, Sweden, also heard the test, and here's what it sounded like from 4,000 miles away.
You're listening to WSPO in Charleston, South Carolina, USA. You're listening to a test broadcast from WSPO, Charleston, South Carolina. This hour of broadcast is designed for reception by worldwide AM radio DX listeners. Normal programming will resume at 1 a.m.
I don't know about you, but I'm simply amazed at that recording, how clear the audio is from 4,000 miles away, and the lack of noise. It seems we here in the United States, and for the most part North America, have a problem with noise, not only from interference from other radio stations, but just the electrical noise floor. If you remember back a few years, Mark Dernberger did a very nice article on the noise that he found in his home. My receiver here in Lima, Ohio, starts picking up noise at S9. Out in North Dakota, it was more like S3. To those folks in Norway and Sweden, it's S1 or less. If I might get political for just a moment, I'm amazed that the Federal Communications Commission will bust pirate stations and hobbyists who are operating with more than 0.1 watts. Yet this noise that we experience from everyday life, from objects, computers, TVs, you name it, some of which radiates for as much as 2 miles or more. Here in Lima, Ohio, we have a couple spots in the town where buzzes and crackling and static will overcome a local 1,000-watt AM radio station. Lacking noise, you can hear all sorts of signals coming in, such as these two recordings made by Og Jorgen Sedal of Norway. Here's his recording of a station out of Georgia. Listen to how clear the audio is, as well as the background noise. And what about this catch out of Colorado?
From Monument to Raton, this is KWRP Pueblo, KCMN Colorado Springs, and K262 BB Boone, the I-25 Radio Network.
Kind of
So there you have it. The WSPO test was a great success. And we learned a little bit about noise and how it affects your ability to hear radio stations. By the way, if you'd like to help us out with DX tests, it's very easy to do. There's two ways to help. You can either donate some stamps so Brandon Jordan, our DX test coordinator, can send letters to radio stations asking them to test, or you can make test suggestions. If you'd like to contact Brandon, his name again is Brandon Jordan, and his email address is swl.tn.usa@gmail.com. Or you can send a muse to us with some information and we'll forward it on to Brandon. Or you can send a letter here and we'll forward that on to Brandon as well. Good listening, good DX, and get out and support radio.
The Turtles extend their copyright fight to Pandora. The suit follows a win in court over Sirius XM by Ben Cesariot on October 2, 2014. After a copyright victory in federal court against Sirius XM that is being widely celebrated in the music industry, the 1960s band The Turtles have taken aim at another big music outlet, Pandora Media. Flo and Eddie, the company set up by members of The Turtles, whose hits include Happy Together and She'd Rather Be With Me, filed a class action suit against Pandora in federal court in Los Angeles, accusing the internet radio giant of copyright infringement under California law for playing its songs without permission. The suit asks for more than $25 million in damages. The Pandora suit rests on a little-known aspect of copyright law that has become a focal point in the music industry lately. Federal copyright protection applies only to recordings made on or after February 15, 1972. And because of that limitation, many digital radio outlets like Pandora and Sirius XM do not pay recording royalties for older songs. A patchwork of state laws apply for pre-1972 recordings, but the extent of their protection is in dispute in a range of lawsuits from around the country. A Pandora spokesman said that the company was confident in its legal position and pointed out that Pandora, like Sirius XM and others, pays separate songwriting royalties on all spins, including pre-1972. About 5% of the songs played on Pandora are from before 1972, and according to Pandora's most recent financial reports, it paid a total of $343 million in music licensing costs last year. The Turtles set off a wave of new cases last year by filing class action suits against Sirius XM in California, Florida, and New York, asking for more than $100 million in damages for having its records, made before 1972, played without permission under state laws. The major record labels followed with their own suit against Sirius XM, as well as another one against Pandora. The cases have been seen as an important test of copyright law for new kinds of digital media, as well as a possible impetus for new legislation that could clarify the issue. In the first major ruling on this issue, the Turtles won summary judgment in the California case. The judge ruled that Sirius XM had infringed on the group's performance rights, the right of a copyright owner to control how its work is played in public, for broadcasting its records without permission. That ruling yielded both excitement and confusion in the music industry. If it is followed by other courts, the ruling could result in a huge royalties windfall for older artists. But the decision applies only to California, and it also seemed at odds with another case. In the major label suit against Sirius XM at state court in California, a judge made a tentative ruling in August that cast doubt on the idea of a performance right for recordings under California law. That case is still pending. Sirius XM's chief financial officer, Donald J. Freer, said at an investors' conference in Scottsdale, Arizona, that his company would appeal last week's federal decision. He also called for legal clarity about the issue, reiterating a point his company's lawyers had argued at trial, that if Sirius XM was liable for infringement for playing the Turtles' records, then so was every AM/FM station, bar, restaurant, stadium, internet webcast, or satellite radio guy. "I think everybody should get paid, and I think everybody should pay," Mr. Freer said at a Deutsche Bank conference that was broadcast online. "But to get there, there needs to be a change in the laws, and it shouldn't be coming from the bench. It should be coming from the legislature. A bill introduced in Congress this year, the Respect Act, would establish performance royalties for recordings made before 1972. That bill has also been faulted for not extending full copyright protection to those recordings, a move that would give older performers powers like so-called termination rights, which let artists reclaim their old works from record companies. For the DX Audio Service, I'm Wally Warrow in Dallas, Texas.
This is Radio Luxembourg, AM and FM. And so we come to the end of our programs in English for this morning. We sincerely hope that you've enjoyed the music you've heard and that you'll rejoin us again this coming evening. We broadcast with an omnidirectional power of 1,300,000 watts AM on 208 meters, 1440 kilohertz in the medium wave band. Radio Luxembourg can also be heard at 49.26 meters shortwave. And our FM frequencies are 88.9, 92.5, and 97. On behalf of the staffs both in Luxembourg and London, this is Bob Stewart, wishing you God's blessing and peace. And a good night and good morning, wherever you may be.